Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome back, everybody. Andrew Brace is joining us again. Today, we're talking about dog breeding, and he's going to be sharing a lot of knowledge that he's accumulated in the course of a lifetime in dogs.
As far as the breeding is concerned, I've never considered myself a large-scale breeder. I just bred a litter when I needed something to show myself, but I absorbed a lot of the great breeders' breeding principles and realized that you always have to breed the best of the best to get the best. And when a litter arrived, it was essential to be as critical as possible.
So let's talk about breeding dogs. You had a recent post, social media, that I found, and it was so on point for a lot of people. And you talked about reading pedigrees and researching dogs and really knowing what's behind your dogs. And I would love if you could speak to why that is so important. And I'd really like to delve into this a little bit, specifically the details of how you understand the impact of a pedigree.
The Facebook post that you're referring to was prompted by my having read several posts from experienced and successful breeders in various breeds who were bemoaning the decline of their breeds. And they were placing the blame on a new generation of breeders who either lack knowledge or whose prime incentive is commercial gain. If a breeder's, and I'm putting that in quotes, if a breeder's main reason for breeding is making money, we have to accept that they feel no responsibility whatsoever to the breed, its health and welfare, or maintaining its breed standard. Now, such people will never consider their lack of knowledge an impediment because they feel no obligation to the breed. And they will always be a thorn in the side of the dedicated breeder who is constantly aiming to improve their stock. As in the eyes of the puppy-buying public, who seldom carry out sufficient research, a puppy is a puppy. Now, those breeders who think breeding a winner is simply a matter of mating a winning bitch to a winning dog are another matter. They fail to realize the value and implications of the pedigree and do not understand what a valuable breeding tool this is. However, you need to be able to read a pedigree, and this is where the truly great breeders score. The pedigree form supplies a lot of valuable information, provided the reader has researched the dogs who appear in it. They'll study a pedigree of at least 5 generations, and if they don't know all the dogs in it personally, they'll research them through either seeking out photographs or simply by asking the older breeders who are still around exactly where these dogs scored and failed. And in this way, they build up a comprehensive picture of their dog's ancestry. They will, over a period of time, be able to assess what faults and virtues lie behind their breeding stock, and possibly more importantly, establish which dogs were responsible for producing them. They'll analyze the level of line breeding and consequently determine which dogs have the greatest influence on their own. And with this information, they'll be in a position to decide which dogs can be doubled up on when a mating is being considered, and which should not. I think I mentioned in the post, one of the greatest breeders of our time was Marjorie Bunting. She had Ragus, Norwich, Norfolk and Border Terriers. Now, not only could Marjorie take a blank sheet of paper and write out from memory a 5-generation pedigree, which always used to astound me, she was also able to describe in detail every single dog whose name she wrote, faults and virtues. I mean, she was just one of those genius master breeders. The great breeders also understand that correct is not produced by mating two extremes. Rather, the potential parent who lacks in one area should be mated to a dog that excels in that failing. So, as an example, a dog that's slightly straight behind will not produce puppies with perfect rear angulation by mating it to a dog that is hopelessly overangulated. Its chosen mate should be a dog that has correct angulation. And, you know, some of the cleverest breeders I've known are Alan Taylor and his late partner Idris Jones, who had the Elroyd Pembroke Welsh Corgis. Now, Idris in particular had the knack of seeing something in dogs that weren't necessarily winning if he felt they had something to contribute to their own breeding program. Having identified such a dog, they'd then study the pedigree to check what was behind it. Sometimes they'd take a gamble on an outcross, but then bring the next generation back into their own breeding. And they produce some fabulous Pembrokes. I remember Bill Taylor telling me that some of their most successful Pekingese had been bred from outcross matings, provided the two parents were themselves strongly line-bred. So the ability to read a pedigree is an art, and it's something that can be learnt in time. But the pedigree form is not just a piece of paper. It's something that can be the keynote to a breeder's success.
Absolutely. And one thing that I'd like to go back and just pick up very quickly, as we transitioned into this particular topic, you said that breeding requires breeding the best to the best. And then you also say that doesn't mean you breed a winner to a winner. I understand exactly what you mean, but I'm asking you if you would expand on that just a bit more so that people understand why those two are not contradictory.
Okay. The way that dog shows have evolved is such that we have focused on show dogs. And in many breeds, this has meant that dogs that are perhaps a little exaggerated in one way or another have taken the eye of the judge over the dogs who are maybe more correctly balanced, maybe more correctly constructed, because they have that little sense of drama about them. And, you know, I've been faced with classes in the breed ring where you instantly look around and dogs are catching your eyes because they have tremendous necks or they have wonderful heads or whatever. And then as you're halfway through the hands-on, this dog walks in front of you and you just look at it and you think, well, this dog is so correct. I mean, there is very little to fault with it, but it is not the flat catcher. As a judge, your responsibility is actually to reward that dog over those dogs that have probably won a ton of best in shows by virtue of the fact that they fly around the ring and have their long necks, gay tails, and are dripping in hair.
Thank you very much, sir. I so much value that observation.
That kind of answer the question.
Yes, it does. And I think that it is something that we certainly see here in the United States, and sounds to me like perhaps you see it in the United Kingdom as well.
As a judge, it's probably sort of something of a heresy for me to say that just because a dog is a top-winning dog doesn't necessarily mean it's an outstanding example of its breed. But if I'm truthful, that is and can be the case. Listen, don't get me wrong. I love coming to the States. I love your dog shows. But I have to say that oftentimes I will pick up a class dog and take it through over dogs of whom I've seen 100 pictures in the magazines. I happen to think it's what it says on the can, best of breed.
Absolutely. So a little segue here, and I appreciate your tolerance of my obsessing about that particular question. In the UK, I think it is more common that you see folks combine exhibiting and judging. It's done here, you know, Pat Trotter and some of these folks, but it's not as common. So how did that work for you? I mean, you had some very, very successful beagles. How did that work in the United Kingdom in your judging career?
Many of our top judges still show dogs, and they manage to combine the two activities satisfactorily. Some go down the route of transferring ownership to a relative or friend and having their dogs handled by someone else when they are judging at the same show. Now, that doesn't sit easy with me, and it causes understandable resentment amongst other exhibitors. I had done extremely well with the beagles. My bitch, Too Darn Hot for Trag Band, held the breed record for challenge certificates for many years and was a best in show winner. She was sired by a very influential American stud dog who'd been imported by Catherine Sutton, who was one of the legends of the British dog scene. Then her grandson, Dial-In Tolliver of Trag Band, was a multiple best in show winner and subsequently became one of the breed's most significant stud dogs. But when he was coming to the end of his career, I decided that I should finish exhibiting. because by now I was judging more and more. And I think when you're judging so frequently, you have to make the decision to basically to do one thing or the other. I know others disagree, but that's how I felt. So at Crufts in 2000, I showed a dog for the last time.
That had to have been difficult after so many years.
It was, but I genuinely felt, Laura, that when you are judging to that extent, and I don't care what anyone says, whether you like it or not, there is a slight conflict of interest. To be perfectly honest, I mean, I was walking in the ring sometimes and coming out with the best of breed ribbon and thinking to myself, did I actually win that because they thought the dog was the best, or did I win it because, you know?
Right.
And I'm judging 6 months down the road, and it worked for me.
Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute.
How much is that dog in the window?
Okay, crew. I hear it pretty much every day now. I love Pure Dog Talk. And that makes my heart happy, because I love doing it. I started hosting Pure Dog Talk as a way to reach out to members of our community with education and resources to enable you to succeed and move forward in your goals and ambitions. And your response has been literally overwhelming. The podcast has been downloaded well over 250,000 times to date. That's incredible. All of this information is free to exhibitors around the world at the touch of a button. But here's the reality check. Money really does make the world go round, guys. So I created a special patrons group. This funding source helps cover the expenses of audio editing and website hosting and technology and like that. Patrons keep Pure Dog Talk's fountain of knowledge flowing freely. And like the NPR of dogdom, our patrons support Pure Dog Talk with monthly gifts. We even offer advertising and sponsorship opportunities that you guys may not have known about. So drop me a note, laura@puredogtalk.com, and I'll let you know how you can help share the love. Judging dogs in the UK, in Europe, in some of the Asian countries, some of the places that you've traveled, versus the United States, our system is pretty specific unto itself. And I would love to hear your thoughts on the differences in the style and the quality of the dogs, in the presentation. And I would dearly love to have you speak to the written critiques and your secrets for providing a critique that's useful. Because I think exhibitors in this country love the concept. So I'd love to hear how that works for you.
Well, I mean, today the dog world is truly cosmopolitan. And breeders are able to utilize the best bloodlines available worldwide, thanks to the advances in travel and science. And consequently, breeds have become more international, though obviously there remain some where type differences are quite noticeable. The most obvious examples, of course, are some of the sporting breeds in the USA. Firstly, when judging internationally, you need to be familiar with the breed standard that is in force in the country where you're judging. And sometimes this calls for a little adaptation, if you like, to your mental template of a breed. But we're always influenced by what we're used to seeing at home. And it's not that easy to get away from our basic perception of classic breed type. Our judging can also be affected by the level of quality that we're used to seeing on a regular basis. And I well remember Bill Taylor, for whom I had the utmost respect as a world-class judge. Bill was absolutely one of the best. Judging a gun dog group in the UK, winner was a Welsh Springer, who was a decent dog, but not spectacular in my opinion. On the drive home, I asked Bill about the Welsh, as I felt that the English setter that stood second was far superior. And he admitted that he had probably been overly enthusiastic about the Welsh, because the overall quality in the breed in the States and Canada at that time was pretty poor. And he went on to point out that he'd seen many better English setters. So we are coloured by what we're used to seeing.
Absolutely.
Now, when I began judging overseas, the sport in some countries was still relatively young, and consequently you had to judge a lot of dogs that weren't in the best condition, were poorly presented and handled. Today, pretty much everywhere in the world has a high level of handling and presentation. In some countries, too much so. as extremes in grooming do infuriate me. Experienced exhibitors now know not to bring me poodles with hair pieces or Shih Tzu sporting those ridiculous Eiffel Tower fans. Doesn't make you popular, but you know you're doing it for the sake of the breed. Judges always hope to get a ring full of dogs that are clean, well-schooled and handled with stable temperaments. And for this reason, I love judging in the States. I have the hugest admiration for your professional handlers. They do an amazing job, and the really top ones are magicians. The bond that they build with their charges is truly admirable. And, you know, it's little wonder that some of your most successful handlers go on to become outstanding judges, because the thought process is exactly the same. Handling is the art of emphasizing a dog's virtues whilst disguising its faults. Judging is all about recognizing the virtues, yet getting the faults into perspective.
I think that is an absolutely perfect explanation, and I am so glad that you laid it out in that way, because I think too many times our exhibitors lose sight of that fact, that as handlers, we have had to select which dogs to show and which dogs not to, the best handlers.
Absolutely.
And that is by knowing the quality of what's on the end of your leash, and only showing the best is part of the deal, in my opinion.
Basically, in the UK, we have very few professional handlers. The vast majority, 90%, more than 90% of the dogs at all shows are owner-handled. And most of these people do a great job, don't get me wrong. And they have the advantage over someone who is handling what I refer to as a pickup dog rather than a dog that is living with them 24/7. Because they know every little nuance of that dog and how it's likely to react to any situation. So that does give them a little bit of an edge. But some countries, unfortunately, have produced so-called professional handlers who have clearly watched a lot of American videos, bought some flashy jackets, and race around the ring with dogs of indeterminate quality. And they often carry too many dogs to really do justice to, and it's obvious that they aren't kept in the best of conditions. These are the guys that are just doing it to make a buck. They aren't handlers, as I understand the word.
We do see those here in the United States as well.
I'm sure.
I mean, I think it is something that happens, because the truly gifted are our pop stars, right? They are our rock stars.
And you have many of them. I am lost in admiration for their talent. And the fact that the majority of them have started off as kids, shoveling shit and doing all the menial stuff before they ever step in a ring. I mean, that is true dedication. And, you know, the best handlers are those that are so skillfully unobtrusive that they just seem to merge into the background. These experts have the ability to project a dog to the judge at first sight, and they also will have studied the judging before they get in the ring themselves and understand exactly what is required of them. Because I would love a dollar for every time I've said to an exhibitor, now would you please do that again on a loose leash and at half the speed?
And if they had watched the rings ahead of them, they would know that that was what you would ask.
Mm-hmm. Now, the judging systems, of course, vary around the world. In the UK, we critique the first and second in every class, and that gets published on the Kennel Club website. In the countries that come under the umbrella of the FCI, most shows require a written critique which gets dictated to a ring secretary, a copy going to the exhibitor at the end of breed judging. Now, I know some judges hate writing critiques, but personally, I enjoy the opportunity to explain my assessment of a dog in print. And when writing a critique, I think it's essential to detail the dog's outstanding virtues, but also mention any obvious shortcomings, which can always be done tactfully. I mean, when I do judging seminars and we're discussing critiques, I always say to them, we have two phrases. One is head like a bucket. The other is would prefer cleaner back skull. They mean exactly the same thing, but one is rather more palatable than the other.
And I think that that is an art form. And I, as a writer, as a podcaster, I appreciate that art form. And I would dearly like to see that be something that becomes more of a goal in the United States, for sure.
Yeah, sure.
I just think it's so valuable.
I mean, when I was at school, school, I always remember my English master drilling into me the evils of the weak adjective. So you will seldom find many goods or nices in my critiques. And always remember that it isn't necessary to describe a dog from nose to tail when most aspects of the dog are acceptable. Just concentrate on the major pluses and minuses. And it's also important to make a critique as breed-specific as possible. But that doesn't mean just plucking phrases out of the breed standard. Years ago, I remember one British all-rounder judging Welsh Springers, and in her critique, she mentioned correct vine-leaf-shaped ears repeatedly. And of course, the breed people just fell about laughing. I mean, it's something they'd never dream of putting in a critique.
I think that's part of the problem. You have to know the standard to write a critique.
It certainly helps. And you know, I have a huge respect for the whole Scandinavian dog scene. Their shows, their judges, and their exhibitors. And to them, you know, the critique, and of course they also have a grading system as well. These exhibitors get together at the end of judging, and they compare the critiques that they've had on their dogs. And if you're judging in Scandinavia, you should always be able to read a critique and immediately know whether that dog was graded excellent, very good, good, or whatever.
Interesting. Based on the words that they choose?
Well, exactly.
Huh, very cool.
What happens, Laura, somebody will go up to their friend with their critique and say, well, you know, I've got a very good, but the judge hasn't mentioned that my dog's got any faults. You've got an excellent. And it says that your dog's got a light eye, so...
Right. You know, I spoke with Jenny Line, one of my judging idols here in North America.
Can I interject there and add myself to the Jenny Line fan club?
Yes. Oh.
I think she's one of the greats.
She is one of the greats. Honestly, in my opinion, she is amazing.
We have endless Facebook discussions about breeds. I mean, I sat with her at Crufts just last year and watched a couple of groups, and she knows the breeds. She has great passion, and thankfully we generally tend to see dogs through pretty similar eyes. But Ginny is also one of my idols. Sorry, I interrupted.
No, it's totally fine. We were talking about written critiques and, you know, why we don't have them in Canada or in the United States. In the North American system doesn't utilize this, and her speaking to it, and I describe her as the steel fist in a velvet glove, you know, that very school teacher but kind, and I just loved what she had to say about it. So if you haven't listened to Jenny's podcast, you really need to.
Yeah, she's great.
So in the United Kingdom, the Kennel Club has created the vulnerable breeds, and they require vet checks for the best of breed winners.
Can I just correct you there on something?
Okay, please do, because I could very easily have not understood this properly.
Vulnerable breeds are an entirely different matter. Are dogs that are numerically challenged. The original expression was from high-profile breeds. They've now given them a number, which I honestly can't remember. It was a small number of breeds in which the Kennel Club, in its wisdom, considered there were worrying health concerns.
Correct. And I loved the synergy here. When you started talking, you were the towel boy for the vet at the dog show, and the changes that have come through in the Kennel Club in how they approach these high-risk breeds. And you've been very, very vocally opposed to this. You've written about it. You've spoken about it extensively. Could you just give our listeners here in the U.S. a little bit of an overview? And I have heard people here in the United States opine, if you will, that this was the Kennel Club sort of acquiescing to the animal rights agenda. And if you had any thoughts on that and cared to put that in perspective.
I have any thoughts on that. I mean, that's what they call a rhetorical question.
Yes, it was a rhetorical question, Andrew.
Yes, I've been an outspoken critic of vet checks. Yes, indeed, I have, and I am. You are absolutely right in your assumption about the animal rights lobby, and I've been writing for years warning the British governing body of what was likely to come. Now, these fanatics have permeated so many areas of the sport and the veterinary profession, so much so that purebred is almost now a dirty word. Of course we all want healthy dogs to live with and to judge, but not at the expense of the integrity of the breeds. yes, some breeds had become unacceptably exaggerated, but the breeders in those that had have really grasped the nettle and improved their breeds enormously. Just look at the bulldogs around the world that are regularly taking top honours. I mean, the bulldog breeders have done a fantastic job with their breed, and they still look like bulldogs. I was very vocal about the vet checks when they were introduced, and felt it horribly unfair that a handful of breeds had been singled out for such victimization, because that's what it was. I was always led to believe that the judge's decision was final, and that the right to represent your breed in the group ring was down to the breed judge, not some veterinarian who had never seen sight of a breed standard. When the system was brought in, I actually withdrew from judging these named high-profile breeds in the UK as a matter of principle. I was not subjecting my best breed winner to some vet who then said it wasn't good enough or healthy enough to go in the group. And the first year at Crufts, when so many best of breed winners were prevented from appearing in the group because of the vet's opinion, proved what a farce it was.
My family comes from Clumber Spaniels, so I followed it quite closely.
I'm sure you did, and poor Lana was just distraught.
Oh, she was. She was deeply distraught.
You know, she finished her. She came back and proved the
point. She's a beautiful bitch. I think she placed here at the National in the U.S.
She did, yeah. Anyhow, some of the breeds have now been removed from the list as the result of positive feedback from judges to the Kennel Club, but some remain, and so the situation has not been fully resolved. And, I mean, now you brought this subject up, Laura, could I just say something about health issues in general?
Please, I would welcome your input.
Well, I have a theory as to why it appears that we now have so many problems. In days gone by, breeders tended to have much more of a stockman attitude towards breeds. Pregnant bitches were not pumped full of additives and were fed very naturally. They would often be left to whelp on straw in an outside kennel and basically get on with it. If sickly puppies were born that the bitch didn't want anything to do with, they were allowed to fade away naturally. I am a great believer that nature knows best. And if a bitch isn't inclined to suckle a puppy, that's because she knows instinctively there's something wrong with it. Large litters were seldom reared in the good old days, and culling was quite common. In these days of political correctness, culling, could you imagine? We can't even mention the word.
No, you can't even say it.
It was all about the survival of the fittest. Now today, and a lot of this, I have to say, is down to the veterinary profession, life must be preserved at all costs. Elderly dogs that have little quality of life are kept alive on expensive drugs, whereas previously they would have been put to sleep. Similarly with puppies. Breeders and veterinarians struggle to keep weak puppies alive that would have been culled by a past generation. These puppies then grow up, and many of them find their way into the gene pool. We see far too many pet owners breeding a litter from their pet bitch because they want to finance a foreign holiday or a new car. It's little wonder that we have so many health issues as so many dogs are being bred from that should never have been allowed to survive.
I know that there are going to be listeners on my show who are going to find that hard to hear, but to be honest with you, I agree.
It's not a popular point of view. But I genuinely believe this is why we have so many problems.
I would be hard-pressed to disagree with you. As I said, my very first mentor in wire-haired pointers was still in the 90s and 2000s whelping her bitches on straw in an outside kennel.
Why not? Especially like that.
Yeah. I built my entire breeding program on two different kennels, and hers was one of them. And those are some healthy dogs, because they had to be.
This is it. Survival of the fittest. The way people fed dogs. You know, some of our top kennels were fed not totally on scraps, but, I mean, it was a very, very natural raw meat and kibble. And there weren't any supplements. And, you know, they bred healthy, sound animals.
Well, and I think, you know, there's a lot of places we can go with this. There's a lot of chemicals in our food. There's more chemicals in our world. You know, there's a lot of pieces to this. But legitimately, I do believe that too often we try to take Mother Nature's job away from her.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for joining us, everybody. This has been Andrew Brace in part two of our Pure Dog Talk interview. I hope you'll be able to join us next week for part three. Andrew will be talking about writing and working with the legendary Ann Rogers Clark. So thanks again for joining us. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.